I'm Christopher Lydon with the global economist of health, hunger, and the human emergency, Jeffrey Sachs. His new book marks a very personal turn. The argument is that John F. Kennedy's tragic and miraculous last year in office, just 50 summers ago, is what we've got to be searching now for ways to address the troubles of today. I'm pressing a sort of what-if question. What if it was precisely President Kennedy's turn to peace, to ending the Cold War, to leaving Vietnam, and learning to live with Castro and Cuba that got our 35th president killed? This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one recorded at the JFK Library in Boston in June 2013. Our public session began with 3 minutes of excerpts from President Kennedy's speech at American University in June 1963, which came to be known as his peace speech. It's the keystone in what Jeff Sachs sees as the clear pattern of JFK's last year on Earth.
What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana, enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. Our problems are man-made, therefore they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Finally, my fellow Americans, let us examine our attitude towards peace and freedom here at home. The quality and spirit of our own society must justify and support our efforts abroad. We must show it in the dedication of our own lives, as many of you who are graduating today will have an opportunity to do by serving without pay in the Peace Corps abroad or in the proposed National Service Corps here at home. But wherever we are, we must all in our daily lives live up to the age-old faith that peace and freedom walk together. In too many of our cities today, the peace is not secure because freedom is incomplete. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal.
Jeff, it's a huge pleasure. I'm fascinated with this book. I'm fascinated with the whole thing, starting with the core argument that we're not done with John Kennedy yet, that there's so much to learn in that life, in that mind, in the words of that he and Ted Sorensen wrote like magic. I mean, that conclusion about to the effect that we're all in this for our children and that we're all mortal. So let's get busy. This is a little personal, but I just wonder, you've written a number of other books in effect, with your family and with your children. I sense a kind of underlying pulse here to tell your kids about JFK and what we dreamed in that kind of paradise and what we lost.
First of all, Christopher, let me say that there is just no one in the world that I would rather sit down and have a conversation with than you.
On.
And that is true. This is ongoing for 30 years. And I am so happy to be here. And I'm so grateful. And it is 50 years next Monday, this great speech, which is the centerpiece of the book and which has just really captivated me and grew on me in so many ways.
Why this book for you?
You know, I didn't really know this speech until probably 7 or 8 years ago. I was only vaguely aware of it. And then I listened to it one evening in its entirety, and I was blown away. It bears listening to at least 1,000 times, I can tell you. It's mesmerizing, and it is about taking on the biggest challenges, the life and death issues of a generation, which for President Kennedy was the Cold War and the confrontation with the Soviet Union, and the what seemed to be almost the inevitable reaching of the precipice as occurred at the Cuban Missile Crisis. And for me, it became emblematic of the question of somehow, how can we pierce through what seem to be intractable, huge problems that grip us? And when Kennedy says we have to examine our attitude towards peace because too many think it unreal, too many think it impossible, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control, that is a lot of what we face right now also. Sometimes we feel that we're gripped by forces we cannot control. And here was a leader saying, no, we can solve this. And that's what's so spectacular about it. But what was wonderful for me, Chris, in my growing appreciation of the speech was that I was invited several years ago to give the Wreath Lectures for BBC, which is a very wonderful opportunity and a very wonderful honor. And these Wreath Lectures are given every other year. And I featured this speech in the third of the Wreath Lectures and gave that, as I was touring around the world to give these talks, gave that one in New York at Columbia University. And sitting in the front row was Ted Sorensen. Ted said the most wonderful things that you could ever hear in that context to me. At the end, I came over and he said, you got it. You understand that speech. And he said also, that's my favorite speech. That suddenly, of course, elevated it even more in importance. And so I thought I would write about the speech, but as I began to write about the speech and its beauty, of course, the history becomes completely gripping. What is the role of a speech in history? And what was the meaning of history? And as highly as I had regarded John Kennedy before this book, thinking long and hard about 1963 and what he accomplished that year, to my mind, makes this one of the absolutely pivotal moments of leadership of modern history. And that's really what the book is saying.
Take two things apart here. One, you refer to this as kind of his last year, a kind of annus mirabilis. I mean, incredible things were happening, including important back-channel conversations with Khrushchev and with Castro and the missile crisis and a major United Nations speech. Seen all together, it was close to the big breakthrough. The other thing I'd love you to sort of take apart a little bit is Kennedy's method. He had a theory of peace. He had a process of peace. And it was not magic, but it was the work of lifetimes to come. Give us enough to that we might relearn it.
I think the remarkable thing for me in understanding this as I came to appreciate it, was to see the contours and the timing of his administration, as brief as it was, of the 3 years. It begins, of course, on the first day with what remains to this moment, the greatest clarion call that one can imagine in his inaugural address, and something that I hope and believe generations will thrill to, because it's such an incredible and magnificent address, and it is a call to greater purpose, and it's a call to finding a path to peace, and it's a call to saving the planet. And he says right at the beginning, the existential question for his generation, and it's true for ours, is that we hold in our mortal hands both the ability to end all forms of human poverty and all forms of human life. Because that's the paradox since 1945, that we can destroy humanity through whether it's nuclear weapons or now environmental destruction. Or we have, through our know-how and our technology, the ability to solve the most incredible, seemingly intractable problems. So he sets a high bar the first day, January 20, 1961. And then things absolutely do not go well for 2 years. And it's just stunning to watch the unraveling. And Kennedy came into office absolutely believing that disaster had to be fought against actively, because it was always possible through miscalculation to fall into horrible traps, because he, as a student of history, saw World War I as the lesson for humanity of how the worst possible thing can happen through basic negligence and stumbling along until disaster strikes. And then he finds himself, even with that acute awareness of this, reaching exactly that moment in October 1962. So the first 2 years are absolutely stunning. Tension, screw-ups, profound difficulties.
Escalation, provocation.
You know, of course. So, and you watch this spiraling, and he's so conscious of it also. And he's you see the depth of the human being also in how he's grappling with this and the pain of it and the mystery of it, and trying to understand, why did Khrushchev put those missiles in Cuba? What can he possibly be thinking? Why did they lie again? Why did he break the moratorium on nuclear testing in August 1961 and so forth? Why is he pushing me so hard in Berlin at the risk of nuclear war? And so the first 2 years are stunning in this serious president of brilliance and wit and eloquence and charm, and yet the world reaches absolutely the precipice of this ultra-rational man who is trying to calibrate every step, and yet also stumbles badly, makes terrible mistakes, listens to the CIA in the worst possible moments, of course, in the Bay of Pigs. And then, Chris, from the Cuban Missile Crisis to his death, it's a complete, unbelievable capacity to move events. And so it's watching two stories side by side, and you see the maturation, and you see finally, in my interpretation, that with the Cuban Missile Crisis, he says, enough. Now I must lead. There is no other way. I will lead. And one of the lessons of this for me is that we can't, in the American political system, and in the dynamics of the Cold War and in the dynamics of so much of what we face in this world, things will get out of control without leadership. We don't have a self-stabilizing, self-organizing world. We don't have the nice world of economists, of that wonderful free market equilibrium. We don't have the nice world of political theorists, of the stable balance of power. What we have is a complexity that can spin out of control. And Kennedy finally realizes, I think, in October 1962, this cannot go on.
Okay.
Khrushchev, the same. And so it's actually a pair that does the miracle in 1963. Khrushchev deserves a lot of credit, though it is Kennedy that guides this.
I couldn't agree with you more that Khrushchev is absolutely a required partner in the whole thing. Those letters are really some of the most moving that you can ever read about John F. Kennedy. And on top of them all is Jacqueline's letter to
Khrushchev at the end.
Khrushchev after the assassination. Yeah. It always brings tears to my eyes, and I'm sure everybody. Look, the outline of the story is not only it's familiar, and it's incredibly moving no matter how many times we hear it. You have the combination of, first of all, his Pacific experience in the war. I mean, he nobody knew more desperately the evil of war at every intimate level. There's the Bay of Pigs, folly of the sort of CIA imagination, and then the near catastrophe of the missile crisis. So you feel it in his face as much as in his words. He has seen. And you sense him watching himself, too, and wondering, why am I doing these things? We're just getting deeper and deeper and deeper. And a kind of a radical turn in all of these speeches, and a virtual mission with Khrushchev to end this insane Cold War. I want to leap ahead to this, just leap right into this question. We don't need to stay on it forever. But what if that's why he was killed? And it is the argument of sort of the Oliver Stone view, and of a book that I think may be banned around here, but I consider a serious book called JFK and the Unspeakable by a guy named James Douglas. It's an important book, and it's, and emotionally speaking, it's right on track with yours. This is a man who went through a deeply Catholic, deeply Christian, deeply reflected, philosophical awakening. And was determined at huge risk, at risk specifically of death, to take a stand. He'd faced death before. We know he'd had the last rites of the Catholic Church 5 or 6 times. It didn't seem to scare him. It comes out dramatically in the Douglas book. So, but what if that is inseparable from the motives behind the assassination?
I didn't go there because that would take one into a world that I was neither equipped nor interested in going. But it's
not interesting. It
is an important question, of course, because if the idea that Kennedy was killed, say, in this particular theory that you mentioned, by the higher reaches of the U.S. government itself, say the CIA, of course, that would be of the most calamitous consequence, if that were right. I don't believe that that's right, and I don't believe that that book actually shows that. The book makes lots of inferences that the assassination, there may have been a conspiracy, there may have been a number of people involved, mm-hmm. but I don't think it comes close to showing in any way that this was an act of the U.S. government, for example, of the CIA, say, in retaliation for turning towards peace. None of the specific circumstances of 1963 actually fit that. The argument, remind me the author, sir?
James Douglas.
Yeah, Douglas, that he makes, for example, that Kennedy was resistant to CIA-led activities in Cuba and in Vietnam, and that this was somehow a retaliation for that, or simply the fact that he had to be pushed aside doesn't fit in, oddly enough and sadly enough, in the disastrous error of Kennedy, in the coup that overthrew Diem in Vietnam. The head of the CIA, John McCone, was against it, but the State Department and, I would say, John and Robert Kennedy, President Kennedy was very conflicted, but he went along with the whole thing. It was not a case of trying to hold back the CIA. What he writes in that book is not right, actually. It's just factually not right in terms of the timing. What he says also about Castro, which is that Kennedy was making a rapprochement with Castro, and this was also resisted by the high levels of the CIA, is also factually not correct, unfortunately.
Well, he's on the verge.
Unfortunately, Robert, who really had a lot of the lead of these aggressive actions to try to assassinate Castro and so forth, they were doing this right up until the end, basically. And so it's all not right. And then there's a huge amount. It's not really Oswald, it's a double, it's this. It gets very complicated and not very convincing to me, I have to say.
It does
now,
get...
But let me step back a moment. The part that is moving for us is his quotation of the theologian Thomas Merton.
Yep.
And that's very moving. He says, John Kennedy becomes a peacemaker and he will die for it. And that
he's been marked for assassination.
And that was not Merton based on trying to read FBI and CIA files. That was Merton from Christian morality and a sense of how peacemakers are targets. And they are targets, whether it's Gandhi or whether it's Kennedy or whether it's Robert Kennedy or whether it's Yitzhak Rabin, peacemaker, or Jesus Christ. Peacemakers are targets for assassination. Mm. And one can say in some way, I have a sentence that says it, that in some way one could argue this cause, and maybe if it's, who knows, because I don't know, in any way more than any of the rest of us, what happened on that day in November. It fits a narrative. I don't think it fits the literal facts, but it fits a moral narrative that he took the ultimate risks, and he knew he was taking the ultimate risks, and he knew going to Dallas he was taking very high risks because he was going to a place that had lots of hate for him, which he knew. And he also absolutely had premonitions of death because of his health and his wartime experience. And he also regarded as the highest virtue courage. And he was courageous. There's no question about it. He was a man of great courage. And this last year was an act of courage in every way. You know, he had to basically say to his advisors, back off. I'm running this, and I'm not listening to you very much. I'm going to listen to you enough to do what I need to do to get a treaty signed. So the other beautiful part of this is that, you know, a president can give a wonderful speech, but the accomplishment of 1963 is signing a test ban treaty. The real accomplishment is not the speech. The real accomplishment is the treaty. A treaty requires Senate ratification. It requires two-thirds of the vote of the Senate. So you have to combine soaring vision and ward politics. And that's what John Kennedy did in 1963. He was attentive to every vote and how he was going to get it, and he was not interested in making a point. He was interested in negotiating a treaty. And that's also beautiful for me because I just love the fact that he accomplished something of historic significance. By the way, I argue much bigger significance than we normally give that treaty, and I'll say why in a moment. But John Kennedy was the most practical person Also, he was an idealist and a pragmatist at the same time. That is the essence of great leadership, in my view.
Last word on the James Douglas book, because I don't mean to harp on it, and I don't know that I'd go any further than you do when you say the moral narrative has weight.
Yes.
And I think that's why Douglas called it JFK and the Unspeakable. He thinks there's a conspiracy, but he thinks even more broadly that there is some unspeakable, dark impulse out there, Satan perhaps, call it what you will, that brings down a man of that courage. Thomas Merton also sort of anticipated assassination, but he also anticipated a miracle. And I think, you know, you're writing about the miracle, in an almost unexplainable convergence of forces and gifts and talents that made a tremendous cult of peace for a moment there.
We came, as it's trite to say, but it's impossible to fathom, we came within one shot of ending the world on several occasions. It's unbelievable, but that's so close. And so that is a miracle that we got through this. There was no right to expect we
were
going to get
through this.
But
dwell also on the miracle that JFK woke up in some radical way and said, we have to turn in a different direction.
But, you know, it's not that he woke up exactly, because he was awake. But he stopped stumbling, and he absolutely said in October, I've got to lead. He took the decision of leadership, and that is what part of what I'm arguing for, because I don't find that our politicians lead very much these days. You know, I voted twice for President Obama, but I don't believe he leads. And so I believe this is relevant now. You have to take risks. And, you know, I was very unhappy with a line in President Obama's speech in Jerusalem 2 months ago, which was another fine address, because our president can give a wonderful address. But it's the difference of a wonderful address and making peace that bothers me. And in that address, President Obama actually said to the young people in Jerusalem, don't expect politicians to lead. You have to demand for us to lead. John Kennedy did not say to people on June 10, 1963, I'm just going to sit there till you start demanding peace. He said, we need to find peace. You need to have the courage. We need to move to peace. He didn't say, you have to make me do it, that I'm an elected official and I'm going to follow what you say, which is what President Obama literally said in Jerusalem. I don't mean to pick on him, but we're not going to get peace in the Middle East until he leads, period. So that's the difference here. And that is what I think, you know, it was the decision to lead, but it was also, of course, this incredible deep realization that there were two people who had stared into the darkness like no one else in human history, he and Nikita Khrushchev. And he felt that bond as deeply as you can feel with another human being. And Khrushchev felt the same thing. They knew they were in a unique position. They knew that each was threatened by dark forces around them. They were besieged by their own hardliners. In this sense, this book is right, that Kennedy had to overcome a profound sense of pessimism and recklessness in order to get this done. If you had just gone with the military, they would have destroyed the planet 10 times over. No question about it. And so the thing that he understands in October is that he's not exactly alone. There are two people on the planet. It's himself and it's Khrushchev.
That they're both deeply aware that they're the real threats are the gangs around them.
So the Cold War was real. It wasn't just crazy people on our side, though we had a lot of them. It was absolutely danger on both sides playing against each other. And so it took something more than deciding. It took a genius. It took this true act of genius to understand that in this spiral, which is provoked by hardliners that Kennedy came to disdain, and that he understood that Khrushchev also faced, but also to understand that this tit-for-tat escalation that was going on also could be stopped because both sides, which were doing damage to the other, absolutely had a mutual interest in survival. And, you know, Kennedy's deepest point, a very basic one, although we don't have it very often, ladies and gentlemen, is that the other side is virtuous. You heard statement in that excerpt that even though Americans will find communism deeply repugnant, it doesn't mean that the society, that the Russian people lack virtue. We can still hail them for their great accomplishments in science and in industrial development, in the arts. And when's the last time we've heard a president say that about the Iranian people, for example? When's the last time we heard presidents say that about the Palestinian people? And on Iran, again, you know, if you take the long history of the relations, we have done so many terrible things in Iran, starting, of course, with Operation Ajax in 1953, which was to throw Mossadegh out of office and impose a brutal dictatorship that was U.S. financed and CIA backed and run, that if we had a little bit of empathy and talked, we'd actually find a capacity to move forward. And Obama talked about that at the very beginning, but he didn't act on it. One of the beautiful things, by the way,
I got to ask you, because this obsesses me. Why, in the rules of the game, is it out of the question for the United States, a new president, Obama, to say, by the way, people of Iran, we created your mess. It was our doing. Kermit Roosevelt, it's entirely documented, and it was a horrible blunder. We shouldn't have done it. We drove all the politics into the mosque, and we're still, you and we are still suffering. Kennedy, you know, in his messages to Castro and Khrushchev, couldn't get past those barriers fast enough. Why, you know these great men, Jeff, why is it out of the question to say, by the way, 1953 was a horrific blunder, the original sin in the Middle East?
This speech of 1963 is just about the only time I know that a president gives a foreign policy speech calling on Americans to rethink our own attitudes, not making a list of demands on the other. And that's the genius of this speech. And it's the uniqueness of this speech. He says, first, let us examine our own attitudes. And in fact, the line is, some say it is useless to speak of peace or world law or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them to do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation, for our attitude is as essential as theirs. Unbelievable. How many times do we hear this? Almost never. That's the point. And of course you're right. And with all the things we've done, and who put Osama bin Laden on the payroll first? Who put Saddam Hussein on the payroll? If we had one moment of truth for our country in talking about these things, we'd clear away a lot of the underbrush and we'd be able to actually solve problems. One of the reasons I love this so much is that I have a chance to work in every kind of society imaginable, every color of skin, every religion. We're working in Islamic communities in northern Nigeria, where the bombs, Boko Haram, bombs are going off in Ethiopia. And the most overwhelming reality of our work, and I say our work because Sonia is my partner in all of this, leading the health efforts in Africa. Every single place we've been on the globe, we are welcomed by the people as warmly as you can imagine. And it doesn't matter, these so-called divisions completely mean nothing, actually, when you're working together. Kennedy made that point. Our leaders do not make that point. They don't make that point enough. And if they, and that's what Khrushchev loved about the speech, of course. Kennedy was hailing the Russian people, talking about their virtue, their courage, the destruction that they had faced in World War II, talking about that the loss of territory and lives and property is if would be as if all of the U.S. east of the Mississippi River were completely laid to waste, he says in this speech. So it's the empathy that is this incredible fact which you need in what the political scientists call the prisoner's dilemma or the security dilemma, which is this ironic fact that when two sides are at each other's necks, it seems very dangerous to make a peace move, like you're going to get hoodwinked, like you're going to get taken advantage of. How can we make peace with those people? And for Kennedy to do it in 1963, just months after Khrushchev had cheated Kennedy and nearly blown up the world by placing the missiles in Cuba, was an act of genius in statesmanship, actually. And it stuck. It worked.
It did. President Kennedy made a great sort of point, and it was a campaign point, but I think he really believed it. It was convenient. It was self-referential in a way. But the American presidency was the key place in all the world to begin addressing the fundamental problems, that it was the center of the world. What if that's not the case anymore, Jeff?
Well, it isn't the case anymore in the very specific sense that the world has much more dispersed power. The role of the U.S. in relative terms is naturally less than it was before. We were probably, though the numbers are always very imprecise, and I'm taking a guess at some, what the official statistics would say, maybe 30 or 35% of the global income in 1960. And now it's probably about 18% and going down because of the rise of China and other emerging economies. We don't dominate the same way, but the need to solve problems is every bit as large, of course, and the role of the United States as still the world's largest economy, most powerful military by far, technological leader, should still be great, but it is not there.
Why not?
And this is at the core, probably, of why I have written this book, which is that when you grew up in the 60s, the idea of leadership, because you saw it, was natural. And though I was too young to understand President Kennedy's accomplishments, and my real coming of age in politics was Robert Kennedy, but still you grew up at a time when you knew, sitting by the radio first and then the TV, listening to Cape Canaveral and the race to the moon, and hearing about the war on poverty, and then falling in love with Robert Kennedy and his presidential campaign to solve human injustice, that, to my mind, was so deeply embedded as what leadership is. And you expect, I expect, a president in our system, and in other systems it's a bit different, but I expect this high level of grappling with problems, big problems, the greatest problems. I now have both the pleasure and honor, but also the anxiety of heading a research center with 800 Earth system scientists, mainly climatologists. So they come to me every day and they say, Jeff, it's worse than we thought. You know, last month we found that the level of CO2 in the atmosphere is the highest level in the last 3 million years. It reached 400 parts per million. My lead climate science colleague, I have two of the greatest gurus in the world as climate scientists, one, Jim Hansen, who has been the US government's lead climate scientist for many, many years, and he's based at Columbia University, says we've already passed the level of CO2 at which in earlier times in the planet, the ocean level would be 5, 10, or more meters higher than it is now. We'd be underwater, or we will be underwater when the feedbacks of what we've done take full effect, is what Professor Hansen's saying. So I regard, just as an example, and it's what I write about at the end of the book, our challenge of reorienting a world economy which has become so incredibly large and productive in its ability to commandeer resources that it can actually destroy human well-being and even lead to mass deaths within a 100-year timeline to be a comparable challenge. And just to riff on this, if you'll let me, for one minute, last year we had the hottest year in the instrument record of the United States. We had the hottest single month in the history of the United States, July 2012. We had the worst drought in 75 years, stretching over 60% of the US counties. We had the worst flood on the East Coast with Superstorm Sandy, which was exacerbated by the fact that the sea level out here and in New York is about a foot higher than it was a century ago because of global warming, human-induced climate change. We also had a presidential campaign. Each candidate mentioned climate once. President Obama mentioned it once in his acceptance speech at the convention, and then never again. And Mitt Romney mentioned it just to say he didn't know whether it was real or not. And that's only because the oil companies paid him more. And both candidates and both parties are on the take, and we're driven by big oil to not talk about the biggest reality for our children and our grandchildren. And it's not even a matter of not bold leadership, it's no leadership. And President Obama, who absolutely knows, I guarantee you he knows, won't talk about it, aside from tiny little steps here and there that are completely incommensurate with this challenge. That's the opposite of leadership. This is the biggest defining challenge of our time, is to learn to live in peace with the planet. This is big stuff. That's what a president's job is. He's not supposed to be afraid of ExxonMobil or Rupert Murdoch or the Koch brothers. He's supposed to help guide us to survival. That's his job. This is the difference, and this is what's so beautiful, to come back to the Test Ban Treaty. Kennedy was interested in the bottom line, and he wanted the treaty for two reasons. One is, three reasons. One is he thought that the test ban by itself would slow the development of nuclear weapons. Second, he thought that the next step, and he was proved right, of course posthumously, the next step would be the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and I regard the 63 Treaty as the direct source and ability to negotiate the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was more significant in slowing down the global arms race. But the third point is he proved the most important thing, and that is we can make peace with the other side. Mm. And the point is he wanted that treaty. And so when he negotiated, when he thought about what to do, when he gave his speeches, it was also always, as the rhetoric soared to the highest reaches of political rhetoric that I know. I think it's absolutely on par with Lincoln or with Churchill in some of these most beautiful passages. He also was saying to himself, how am I going to get the two-thirds votes? And he got it. So that's where I want our presidents to think. They have to think big, because if they don't guarantee it, no one else can. So without them, we drift. The problems cannot solve themselves for a lot of deep reasons. They will not solve themselves. And so that's the only job. The job is to be courageous. And that's why also was, you know, one of my least favorite presidents, though he also had great rhetoric at some times, was Ronald Reagan. And my what I regard as the single worst sentence of modern American presidency, when he said the solution to our government is not the solution to our problems, government is the problem. And I have always thought, God, if you believe that, just don't be president, at least. Because we need someone in the presidency that believes that it's there to be used to solve problems.
Jeff, I think of this as a magnificent first round of thinking about what we hadn't thought about President Kennedy coming up toward the 50th anniversary of his death. And it's a wonderful beginning. Thank you. Thank you.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Jeffrey Sachs. He is director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. His new book, which we've been talking about, is To Move the World, JFK's Quest for Peace. The give and take about JFK isn't over until we take up a number of other angles here on Open Source on the way to the 50th anniversary of the president's assassination in November. Or until listeners like you add a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lighton. Thank you for joining the conversation.